presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday evening, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for April the 5th, 2020. Welcome to our look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So time to take a break, and we'll try to get you prepared for what the week ahead may bring. Well, we're going to start right into today's show. Just to let you know, the White House is advising that even though there had not been a planned public press briefing of the White House coronavirus task force, they are now advising that something will take place and roughly scheduled about 6 p.m. Central Time. Obviously, we'll keep you up to date on everything going on with that. And if the White House, when the White House has this briefing, we'll cut right in. But it's roughly looking at sometime around 6 o'clock or so. So just be aware of that. But we're going to focus our show right now on organized labor and how it's dealing with the coronavirus. And joining me now is Bob Ryder. Bob is the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. The CFL is the third largest central labor council of the AFL-CIO. Represents nearly 300 unions and labor organizations, representing over 500,000 union members in Chicago and Cook County. Bob, thank you so much for joining me on this Sunday.
Thanks, Rick. It's a little weird. You know, I've been on your show before, but I've been staring across the room at you, and you know, but you sound close.
Well, good, good. I mean, it's a little weird for everybody these days. Let's face it.
Yeah. No. It's really. It's really, you know, something that takes a lot of adjusting to, but, you know, what we're doing now hopefully will help flatten the curve and we can get back to being in a place where we can, you know, see each other face to face and communicate like we're used to.
We're all hoping for that, believe me. Bob, I was curious, and this kind of struck me as, you know, obviously we had the governor's stay-at-home order except for essential employees from around March 21st, I believe it was. And I guess, do we have too many essential employees under those guidelines?
It's a fair question. It's also a difficult question to answer. You know, the way our society is set up, the way work is set up is, you know, there's so many things that are interdependent on one another. You have construction related to food supply through upkeep of facilities. You have healthcare workers. It's not an easy system to design. I'm sure. In terms of trying to figure out who's essential and who's not. But I don't know if you've stopped in over at your headquarters, you know, the Tribune, and either, whether it's the Tribune or WGN, the two buildings aren't far apart from each other. And the, you know, Tribune offices are in the same building I'm in.
Right.
And, it's a ghost town. It's literally a ghost town. So I do think that what we have in place now has definitely created a situation where people are apart from each other and hopefully in a way where we can promote social distancing and stop the spread of the virus. Essential employees and, you know, a lot of the essential employees that are out there working right now are members of, the affiliate unions that I represent.
Right.
Postal clerks, letter carriers, truck drivers, grocery store clerks, and then the people that are, they're all first responders in some way, in my view, but then we also represent, you know, the doctors and nurses and the LPNs and the service people at Cook County Hospital, nurses and service folks at many other hospitals like University of Chicago. We represent people at Northwestern and so many other safety net hospitals around Chicago. And these are the folks, you know, that are out there in the trenches, as it were, fighting for our health and safety.
And deserve our thanks, absolutely.
But Rick, there's another group, too, I think, that deserves everybody's thanks as well that have been affected by this crisis. You know, the trade show industry started to unwind at the end of February, beginning of March, and the amount of people that are that work in that industry, whether it's the hotel maids, the folks who build the trade show exhibits at McCormick Place, the people that are stagehands in our city's theaters. And these people all went to virtually 100% unemployment. And, you know, the thought behind that is, you know, as we start limiting gatherings, those industries need to scale back down and shut down. And all those folks are suffering economically, but they're doing it for the common good, as it were. And I think we need to take a lot of appreciation for that, and also keep that in mind for those of us who can continue to work, whether it be from home or other means. You know, don't forget the people who lost their jobs in this crisis, so we could all promote social distancing and, you know, protect the health and safety of our greater society.
We're speaking to Bob Ryder. He's the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. I'm Rick Pearson. You're listening to The Sunday Spin.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin on this Sunday evening. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. Joining me on the phone is Bob Ryder. He's the president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. Bob, I was curious, you know, we touched on essential employees, but I mean, we are confronting issues like, you know, separation and wearing masks, those kinds of things. And, you know, some of these people that we know about the healthcare industry and what they're facing. But I'm curious, what about as far as social distancing and those kinds of protections on the job site of others who are deemed as essential employees?
No, that's an important question. I mean, workers are sacrificing for the city and this country, and all of us owe them a debt of gratitude. And one of the challenges that they face is being able to, you know, make sure that their health and safety is safeguarded. I mean, look at grocery store workers, pharmacists. You know, we represent all those folks. There's a lot of concern around making sure that they have the proper personal protective equipment, that there's hand sanitizer, that they have masks, because they're not. Say you go into a grocery store, right, and you're there for an hour. Well, you have exposure for yourself for that hour, but then you're going back home. These folks that are working these stores, they're exposed for their entire shift, right? And I think it's something that we have to make sure that people have in, you know, have the forefront of their mind. So, you know, we're seeing more practices at some of these stores where they're starting to separate customers. But when you pull up to the grocery store and you see the parking lot packed, just, you know, think to yourself, are you, you know, you're not just putting yourself at risk, and you're not just putting the other customers at risk. You're putting everyone that works in that store at risk. So you see that parking lot crowded, you know, maybe look at coming back later. Those folks have, you know, they're taking people as they come, as they arrive in the door.
I mean, I've seen, obviously, at the grocery store, we're seeing more stores putting up kind of plastic dividers to separate the cashier from the customers and that kind of thing. But also in these stores, let's face it, sometimes you can't get 6 feet of separation to go down an aisle. And to have these store workers, I mean, are they getting the frontline support they need?
I mean, I think it varies by It varies by location. It varies by employer. I know that some of the employers have expressed their concern and wanting to, you know, put more things like you're talking about in terms of the separators. But at the same time, you know, I don't know that they're doing enough yet. We've had a lot of complaints around properly stocking with sanitizer for our pharmacists. And, you know, they're coming into contact potentially with people who may have a variety of different illnesses every day. And, you know, that in and of itself, aside from the coronavirus, can help compromise their immunity, right? And then make them more susceptible to COVID-19.
So are we just kind of really, in all of this, like, you know, with everything else, are we just kind of writing the rules as we go here?
I mean, I think that the CDC's put out a lot of good guidelines. I know that in some of our workplaces that, you know, take construction sites, I know that there's a lot of contractors that are putting up, you know, making sure that the job sites are following the CDC guidelines. But this is something else that I want to say. If you're listening right now and you're a union worker anywhere in the city and you think that your employer isn't following guidelines or taking care of you on your job as an essential employee, you need to call your union and tell them, right? Don't put your health and safety in the hands of the employer. Put it in the hands of yourself and the people that are your voice on the job site. Rick, I think that there's a lot of people that mean well, both on both sides of the fence, you know, in terms of our workers and the employers. But my job is to make sure that the workers are protected and that they're given the proper PPE. So we're going to keep you know, elevating that, making sure that people are paying attention. You know, there's disagreement over who should be essential and who's not, I feel a responsibility to all of them that if they're out in the front lines for us, we need to make sure that they have the proper CDC guidelined equipment and protective gear to make sure that we keep them safe.
Well, and I think just the other day, Governor Pritzker kind of echoed what you were saying as far as if there are employers telling people who feel sick that they have to come into work, that they need to be reported for doing that.
Yeah, and I think right now, anyone who believes that their employer is going to come after them for showing up to, you know, because they don't come into work because they're sick or they don't feel well or because they're afraid that their employer won't take their fear of getting sick seriously. I think we need to take a look at those employers. And they're the ones who should have fear and shame, not the worker.
We mentioned about job sites and those kinds of things. What about as far as employers notifying people, these essential employees at various jobs, that their colleagues may have tested positive?
Well, I know of a few instances where that's happened and the employer has shut the job down, ordered deep cleaning of the work site, and before they cleared everyone to come back. And, you know, sometimes this, you know, it's even involved someone who had been exposed who was on multiple work sites, and all those work sites were closed. But I will tell you that I don't believe that that's likely to happen in every instance, and we need to be vigilant about holding people accountable, whether that's the top of the food chain or some intermediate supervisor. The workers of the city need to make sure that if they're out there helping to hold our society and our economy and our structure and our safety net together, that they also have the protections they should have.
But there is also a responsibility on the worker, too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we would, you know, I'm the first one to say, if you're sick, stay home. I mean, I have people in my family who would be susceptible and vulnerable to this virus. I'm trying to do everything I can to protect my family members. I think everyone needs to share in that responsibility. And that's also why, you know, you look at all those workers who are now sitting at home because their industry shut down, and they're the most vulnerable economically, right? Some of these people are going to lose their health care if they haven't already lost it, right? And it's not something that could, a switch that could be flipped. Oh, I had health care through my employer, now I'm going to jump on the ACA. We need to do more for those people, whether it's going to Congress and asking for health care protections for those individuals, or people who can work at home. Don't have your kids playing with the neighbor's kids, right? Don't think that you're somehow immune in your neighborhood and you can go have a party in someone's driveway. Be responsible. Whether you're sitting in your house or you're at work, be responsible. Let's slow this thing down. Let's not break our healthcare system, and let's protect our frontline workers.
Well, and the reason I bring this up is a text message. Basically, some a laborer and some people tested positive, and they're probably afraid of losing their job, losing their paycheck, losing their insurance. They're still showing up at job sites.
Yeah, one of the things that we fought for here, both from Chicago with our elected leaders in Washington and Senator Durbin and all of our great people, and Senator Duckworth and all of our great folks from the congressional delegation, was to get direct payments to workers, to get that $600 added to unemployment. And in this next round, we're fighting to get COBRA protection. So if someone gets thrown off their health care, much like they did in 2000 during the housing crisis in 2008, that we supplement their COBRA payments so they can maintain their health care and take as much of that anxiety as away as possible.
Obviously, there's talk, even though we've gone in phase three, which is you know, part of those expansion of unemployment benefits as well as direct payment to workers. What do you want to see besides maybe COBRA coverage for a phase four bill?
Well, I got to be honest with you. Since this started really ramping up in terms of focusing on federal legislation, you know, blowing past, you know, what the Trump administration was calling for and working with our elected leaders, the CFL has been focused almost completely on that healthcare piece. Mm-hmm. We are supporting and working on all the other things that have come along the way, like direct payment to workers. We were calling for that and working with our folks on paid leave benefits. But the thing that I learned in my career back during the housing crisis was how critical those COBRA payments were. And I don't know that people realize, you know, what can happen, especially for our folks on multi-employer healthcare funds. You know, their reserves right now are even threatened by how crazy the stock market's been. Being able to maintain that health insurance for, I don't know, you know, like, are we going to be in this thing for 12 months? You know, when are some of these industries going to come back? How long can people hold out on the health plan that they have right now? And do we want to see them get thrown off? So while we've been working on every other piece, our effort that we've been trying to lead on has been that healthcare piece. And I've got I continue myself and the rest of my team to have our eye on that ball.
That's Bob Ryder. He is president of the Chicago Federation of Labor. And Bob, like a lot of people, will be looking to see what kind of healthcare expansion coverage is included in any phase four legislation. Bob, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you so much.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to your next half hour of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. We're continuing our discussion about coronavirus and issues involving organized labor. Next week, next week's show, we have rescheduled, representatives from the business community, Rob Carr from the Retail Merchants Association, as well as Mark Densler, the head of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. We're going to talk to them about, obviously, the impact on from the business community. We talked to Bob Reiter earlier, and joining me now on the phone is Dan Montgomery. Dan is the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. Dan, thank you so much for joining me.
No, my pleasure. Thanks, Rick. How are you?
Oh, I'm like everybody else. We're all trying to make do here in kind of a brave new world situation. It's always interesting to come into the radio station on Sunday, even a gorgeous Sunday like today, and just the shock of seeing Chicago virtually deserted.
Right, right. Yeah, I know. And then you think, every once in a while, I think, oh, I'll watch a hockey game. And we can't even do that.
No, but you can listen to the 2010 games,
yep,
including tonight at 6. Yeah. And you know, I was actually, I have to admit, because we always talk, Dan and I talk about hockey and sports, but I was actually, for a brief moment, watching ESPN where they were showing two guys at a EA video game competition using Madden NFL 2020. I mean, yeah. I'm getting a little bit starved for some sports
right.
action.
You got to check yourself every once in a while.
Well, I wanted to have you on much earlier, and this actually kind of tied back to when Governor Pritzker announced the shutdown of the schools, and you know, now we're even past what the shutdown date would be to now we're looking at April 30th at the earliest, although when you look at the governor's daily press briefing and he talks about when the apex of the virus here in Illinois may hit, it could be right around then. It could be late April. And I guess, you know, what should we make of this school year? We're not like other states right now where they have basically ended their school year, but are we in a position where we should just kind of look ahead, do that, and figure out how to adjust from there?
Well, I think, teachers and schools and school leaders have been really focused on what do we do in the moment here, right? And when we first went out around March 16, 17, you know, there were some school districts that were on spring break at that time. Remember, there were, about maybe 24 school districts before the governor's order who'd already canceled in-person classes. In southern Illinois, it's more typical that our schools get out in mid to late May, a little bit earlier than a lot of districts up here. So I think, you know, the focus has been on trying to figure out what we do right now. This week is spring break for my son, who's a sophomore in high school. It's spring break coming up here for CPS as well. So, you know, teachers and other school staff have been really focused on how do we do this. It's painful. It's painful because for a lot of reasons, not just the absence of, you know, in-person communication and that human experience, but we know, you know, so many of our kids don't have the same kinds of access to resources in terms of, you know, computers at home, tablets, iPads, things like that.
Even the Internet.
Even the Internet, you know, and that's true in the city of Chicago. It's true in the suburbs. It's true. There are places far downstate where they don't even have good, you know, cell service in parts of, you know, depending on where you live. You might not have good cell service even at your home.
I think there's parts of rural Illinois that are still on dial-up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, Belleville, which is in the Metro East area, for instance, that's a district where we represent folks, they did a really neat thing. They were using their bus drivers to, you know, it works so many ways. It helps keep the bus drivers working. They get paid. The bus drivers are delivering meals to the students out at home, or they had various pickup spots, and the bus drivers were delivering and collecting back work, like the teachers had Xeroxed packets and things for students to do. And furthermore, they put these mobile hotspots in the buses, and they announced where the buses would be. I think they had three of them around the community at various times, so kids or anyone really in the community could go and be near the buses, and they were near parks and places where people could safely gather or be to get some Wi-Fi. But, I mean, yeah, right? So that's what we have here.
And we're talking, and for folks who don't know Belleville, we're talking about, you know, a relatively, you know, like a suburb of
yeah.
St. Louis.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is not rural, you know, like Cairo or anything like that. You know, we're talking a very big part of Illinois population in St. Clair County is Belleville. So
right.
don't be thinking this is, you know, somewhere in rural Appalachia or something like that.
Not at all. And you know, I heard a teacher talking a week or so ago. She was a CPS kindergarten teacher, or I'm not sure if it's kindergarten, but elementary. And she said before they went out, she had asked her students, you know, what do you have at home for a computer or internet? And, you know, she said maybe half of them said my mom's cell phone. So, you know, you have to then think about, well, how do you spin that out, right? So that mom, maybe she's home, but maybe she's out at work every day. You know, maybe that child could have some time, you know, on her cell phone doing some version of online work, possibly even if it's only watching some videos or something. But there's other siblings, maybe. What if there's an older sibling in high school? You know, so this is exposing, like, I think, you know, I'm not the first person to observe this, but this pandemic is exposing some serious weaknesses and fault lines in our country, and not only along, you know, race and class and socioeconomic things, but just even along, you know, infrastructure in parts of our country. So if, you know, I keep thinking to myself, when we get through this, if there's any good that can come out of this, it's that we really have a new resolve, you know, to rebuild our country's human infrastructure, if you will, and everything like the things we're talking about.
Well, and you know, I'll admit I take for granted the technology. I mean, it's how I work. And, you know, in media, we tend to be kind of ahead of the curve on some of the technology. But I was kind of thinking about how, you know, before the pandemic, we were seeing all these great stories about or even commercials for 5G technology,
right,
and how this was going to change the world. And here you're looking at, you know, 5G technology moving forward, whereas we're talking about, you know, there are families that don't even have access to, don't have access to Wi-Fi.
Yeah. And, you know, and specifically in education, too, I mean, you think about, I was talking to a friend of mine, a colleague of mine that I taught with when I was teaching full-time, who was an English teacher in the high school. I said, well, how is it going? You know, tell me how teaching is going. And the very first words out of his mouth were, well, I can tell you this, online education is not the future. And, you know, we kind of had a chuckle about it. And, I mean, I think there's many people who will come out of this experience and say, ah, look at this, distance learning, it's the future. And what I think we all are seeing, and I don't think it's just teachers and school staff, it's parents and it's students, yeah, you know, there can be parts. I'm not saying there shouldn't be ever online learning or it doesn't have a place or anything like that. It can do many wonderful things. But, look, we need the human connection. You need to get people in a room together. Children, young people, they need the guidance. And the human connection is the way we've taught, you know, since the beginning of humanity, and I don't think that's ever going to change. And I think anyone who thinks that even where we can do this really well, that it's a replacement for in-person learning and all the things, if you really think about what happens in school, all the social skill building, all the teams, the sports, the clubs, theater, music, whatever it is, all that, it adds up to a kind of human building experience that we've managed to put together for our children, for better or worse. But it can't be replaced online. And, you know, everybody's soldiering ahead, doing their best. And there's some really great stuff happening. I hear about it every day. But, you know, make no mistake, it doesn't replace real school and where we'd all rather be together in one classroom, in one building.
Sure, the character building, the culture building, and you think of, you know, as adults, you think of, you know, that fifth grade teacher that made such a big difference in,
yep.
you know, basically propelling you into your careers.
Yeah, that's so true. And you know, I've heard we also represent folks in higher ed and community colleges and four-year institutions. And every day you can read online. I mean, if you just scan Twitter or Facebook and other social media, you can hear really compelling testimony, if you will, from people who are teaching online. And mind you, in higher ed, there's a greater infrastructure for distance learning, right? I mean, that's been occurring for some time. So they already have, in a lot of disciplines, a sort of better means to deliver it. But time and again, you hear professors and instructors talking about the difficulties that their students are living through right now. There's a great article in today's New York Times, I don't know if you saw it, about they profiled a few students who are undergrads and Haverford College in Pennsylvania. And, you know, they have a girl there who's on total scholarship, and her parents are on a food truck in Florida. And, you know, the economic devastation here is hitting all these students, too.
Absolutely. I mean, I did look at, there was a piece that CNN had online about teachers trying to redefine class, and only had a few days to kind of do it before schools were shut down. Think about that. I mean, at least 124,000 schools have been shuttered across the United States. 124,000 schools.
Yeah.
Now factor in how many students.
Right.
So, I mean, and obviously, you know, teachers still want to try to have a connection here. And I guess... you know, and as I said, some of these teachers, they only had a few days before schools shut down. They don't know what electronic access they have. They don't know, you know, how do teachers in this atmosphere still kind of try to work to maintain that personal environment with the
right.
students?
Teachers I've been talking to, I mean, it's a kind of mishmash of a lot of different things, right? If your school has some platform like a Google Classroom or a Blackboard or even Zoom, some schools are using Zoom, though we've all heard about some of the issues there.
Yes, please.
You know, they're using them. Some schools are saying you should have class synchronously. In other words, they've created a new schedule and say, you know, Tuesday morning at 11 a.m., these classes will meet, you know, online. And when I've asked my teacher colleagues, you know, what is that like? What sort of return are you getting? They're saying it varies. It kind of depends on the year. They're sophomores, you know, maybe half of them. Seniors, 30 to 40% of them. And then they follow up because you don't know what the story is there. Is there sickness in the home? Don't they have internet access? So the teachers, a lot of them are making phone calls. They're putting out, you know, emails and things like that. One of the things in our discussions with the state board, and I have to just sort of say right here that the state board, I can't heap enough praise on one on the governor, but the deputy governor for education, Jesse Ruiz, state superintendent Carmen Ayala, and ISBE, the state board, and their staff have been really terrific. And the kind of collaboration that we're doing, and we are on the phone every day around this, it's really very inspiring, and thank heavens it's working that way. But, you know, there one of the things we're saying there are like, look, you can't take attendance the same way, but we have to try to reach every kid. And so if you know, persistently you can't get a hold of someone, we're then saying, well, then that's when you've got to reach out and have counselors or social workers try to contact the family. In some cases, you know, I've heard stories they just can't. You know, maybe the family left and went somewhere, you know, things like that. But it is a great concern. I think teachers are really, you know, nothing if not creative and know how to do, because just in the best of times, the most well-planned lessons, you know, you never can exactly predict what some sophomore is going to do third period in the middle of Julius Caesar, you know what I mean, or in third or fifth grade, whatever. So
students can be very clever, yes.
so students, so so teachers have to, you know, think through creatively, and they do. So people are using kind of everything in the toolbook, and then, you know, learning stuff on the fly here. You know, if you didn't know Blackboard or Zoom, you know, people are really trying to learn this stuff quickly. But again, you know, I don't think anyone is under any pretensions that we're all gonna get through the rest of the curriculum like we had been able, or been anticipating. You know, there's thinking about grades, right? And we're doing grades in such a way that kids can help the grade, you know, raise a grade from where they were on March 17th up, but not let kids get hurt in terms of grades. But there's a lot of questions, you know, that we need guidance from the state board, and they're working on it towards graduation requirements and things like that. I think the big thing in the education community is we don't want kids to be hurt by this. I know it sounds odd because everybody's being hurt, right? But we want to minimize the interruption, the setbacks that they're going to experience, and help them.
We're speaking with Dan Montgomery, the president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. And Dan, you got into a point I was going to ask you about, is the kids don't deserve to be hurt by this.
Right.
And yes, we've all been hurt to some degree or what, but I mean, to me, you know, I look at this as, you know, are we approaching kind of a lost year?
Well, you know, you have to remember, we got about three quarters of the way through the year. Okay, so let's not forget that, right? A lot of great stuff happened. I would sort of reject the idea. I've heard someone say this. Well, it's a whole lost year. Let's hang on to that, and for the kids' sake too. I mean, you can spend time, and a lot of teachers I know are spending time right now, kind of reviewing and making more concrete things kids have already learned now, and that's of great value. It really is. So if you're, let's say you're in the CPS or you're up in a lot of school districts in this area, you've had your spring break or you're having it this week, and then you've got about a month of school left, May, and a couple of weeks or a little bit more or a little bit less, depending on where. I wouldn't say it's a lost year. I really feel for the seniors in high school. I mean, I taught high school, and this is a time of year that there's a lot of capstone events. You know, there's prom. There's commencement. There's so many things that are rituals that you look forward to for your 4 years of high school, and that's hard. And getting into college and wondering like that, and those are big questions. But I'm confident, you know, who knows what the future holds in terms of how long we're in this phase and what the beginning of next year will look like. But, you know, we will get back to school. There will come a day we are on the other side of this, and we'll have to take stock. And the learning that has been lost during this time, you know, yeah, it's not going to be easy, but we can work harder and bring kids back up. So, you know, kids are so resilient. And, I mean, the other thing I would say is I'm hearing great stories about the kids at this moment, you know, asking their teachers, how are you? And the children and young people, they're just so magnificent. And you know, we have to really be tuned into their emotional growth and state at this time to try to support them, because there is a lot of fear, and it's uncertainty, which is hard. So I try to be optimistic, and I know our teaching staff does that too, and every day kind of bucking up the students and saying, yeah, this is a setback, but it's nothing we can't get over.
And I mean, maybe last year was too harsh a phrase, but I guess maybe just the fact that, you know, we will have to look at some remedial education when this is over.
Yeah, I mean, and again, there you get into differences, you know, real gaps in race and class and money and socioeconomic standing and resources. And that's where we want our public schools to make up the difference, right? And there are big fiscal questions hanging over the state and everybody going ahead, too. And, you know, thinking about, well, if we add learning time back, how do we do that? How do we pay for it? How do we run buildings and staff for extra time? Will people come? When
right.
do we do that? You know, will they come? You know, if we build it, will they come? You know, if schools start somewhat early somewhere in the fall, say, earlier than normal to try to make up time, is that something a community is going to want? Those are going to be community decisions done by school boards around the state, but they will also be tied to fiscal constraints. So, you know, that's one of the many things everybody's thinking about right now, is what could that look like and what are other things we can do? I'm sure you will see that all of us in the education community kind of trying to provide more and more summer resources that will be free, so it's not dependent on your parents' ability to pay, that kids can do, even if it's not required, but kids can do to not lose too much.
I mean, there's just, as I said, it's so much uncharted waters here. Yeah. And I mean, for example, you know, how do you do grades when, mm-hmm. Yep. in this kind of atmosphere?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I mean, teachers can still give comments, and they still are. I've talked to, you know, my field is English, so I'm always talking to English teachers, and they, you know, they're still having papers written, and that's relatively easy to do remotely, where you can give feedback on a piece of writing. But all sorts of work is still being done. We've been pushing and promoting this idea of capstone projects at the end. We get close. So maybe you haven't gotten through the entire curriculum for, you know, AP U.S. History or what have you, but can you do a project that's really going to help the kids grow and that they can learn continually, having them do a big project as a sort of a year-end thing. And those things often, especially in the upper grades, they're fairly independent work. You know, you can keep checking in with the teacher, but students can do a lot on their own. I think it's harder, you know, in the lower grades